Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Soren Kierkegaard, narrated by Charlton Heston, Part 3.
Victor Eremita claims to have discovered the seducer's diary in the same antique desk where the rest of A's papers were hidden. But A claims not to have written these pages. Instead, he insists that he surreptitiously copied them from the diary of an acquaintance named Johannes. Johannes is a vampire-like character who must renew his frozen, lifeless soul repeatedly by seducing innocent young girls. In the most horrifying pages Kierkegaard ever wrote, we see this seducer captivate, inflame with passion, and abandon Cordelia Thal, a young woman of modest means but rich character. Like A, and unlike Don Juan, Johannes seeks his pleasures not through a direct assault, but rather by stealthy, calculated means.
Various means of surprising Cordelia are conceivable. I could try to raise an erotic storm capable of tearing up trees by the roots, but it would be aesthetically incorrect. I do not relish romantic giddiness, and this state is to be commended only when one is dealing with girls who are able to acquire a poetic afterglow in no other way. Moreover, one easily loses out on the real enjoyment, for too much turmoil is also damaging. On her, it would completely fail in its effect. In a couple of drafts, I would have imbibed what I could have had the use of for a long time. Indeed, worse yet, what I, with circumspection, could have enjoyed more fully and richly.
Johannes' seduction of Cordelia is long and complex, involving frequent, apparently accidental meetings. He encourages an inept suitor named Edward, so Cordelia's erotic impulse will be simultaneously stimulated and frustrated. Then, out of the blue, Johannes proposes to her. The surprise of his proposal is offset by its prosaic character. Throughout their engagement, Johannes keeps Cordelia off balance by sending passionate letters, but remaining cool and aloof when with her. He takes her to gatherings of newly engaged and cloyingly affectionate couples, persuading her that engagement and marriage are bourgeois conventions. So Cordelia, not Johannes, breaks their engagement. She's concluded that conventional marriage insults the passion she's come to feel. Finally, the seduction is consummated at a country villa, after which Johannes abandons Cordelia forever. This is no ordinary seduction aiming for simple physical pleasure. The seducer is satisfied only by driving an innocent young girl to the highest level of passion, where she gives herself totally to him. It's spiritual rape. The rape is rendered even more gruesome by the utterly innocuous manner in which it's carried out. Throughout the seduction, Johannes assumes the demeanor of a proper, slightly stodgy, and bumbling middle-aged bachelor. He appears to be an utterly prosaic, harmless character, but he secretly and indirectly stokes the erotic fires of Cordelia's soul. All along, the girl doesn't understand what's going on. Even when the seduction's accomplished, she has only an outraged suspicion that she's been violated. Johannes has taken no overt action that she can complain about. There are several points worth noting about the seducer's diary. First, this is the first and most dreadful of several accounts which may describe Kierkegaard's love affair with Regina. It's as if Kierkegaard were saying to Regina, "This may be the way it was between us. I may have been toying with you, experimenting, amusing myself." But it's clear that Regina knew better. Second and more important, this story is a warning to aesthetes. Kierkegaard's saying that a consistent and thoroughgoing aesthete will end up like Johannes. A seems to get this message because he expresses deep anxiety when he reads the seducer's diary.
Hide from myself, I cannot. I can hardly control my anxiety that grips me at this moment when I decide, in my own interest, to make an accurate, clean copy of the hurried transcript I was able to obtain at the time, only in the greatest haste and with great uneasiness. The episode confronts me just as disquietingly and just as reproachfully as it did then. I, too, am carried along into that kingdom of mist, into that dreamland where one is frightened by one's own shadow at every moment. Often I futilely try to tear myself away from it. I follow along like an ominous shape, like an accuser who cannot speak.
A has a sense that something's dreadfully amiss in his life. In the second volume of Either Or, he receives two long letters from Judge William that appeal precisely to his unease. Judge William tries to win A over to the ethical way of life. The judge is a bit stodgy, long-winded, and self-satisfied. But he's beyond question a devoted husband, a dutiful public servant, and a concerned friend. Only this concern motivates his lengthy letters. The judge faces the problem of how to persuade an aesthete for whom the world is either interesting or boring to begin to view life in terms of right and wrong, good and bad. If he simply accuses A of irresponsibility, he only begs the question of lifestyles. He'll probably lose A's attention. A will perceive these moral harangues as boring. Of course, A might find them amusing in something like the way he came to enjoy the perspiring philosopher. But how can Judge William actually reach the aesthete? In the two letters of Volume 2, Judge William devotes many of his words to analyzing aesthetic existence. He thinks A can continue to exist as an aesthete only if he doesn't completely and clearly understand the character of his way of life.
Every human being, no matter how slightly gifted he is, however subordinate his position in life may be, has a natural need to formulate a life view, a conception of the meaning of life and of its purpose. The person who lives aesthetically also does that. And the popular expression heard in all ages and from various stages is this: one must enjoy life. There are, of course, many variations of this, depending on differences in the conceptions of enjoyment. But all are agreed that we are to enjoy life. But the person who says that he wants to enjoy life always posits a condition that either lies outside of the individual or is within the individual in such a way that it is not there by virtue of the individual himself.
Whether we base our happiness on beauty, health, talent, wealth, or social position, we run the risk that fate may deprive us of exactly that which gives life meaning. What fortune gives, fortune may take away. When this happens, the aesthete despairs. But William argues that this shows he was in despair all along. He supports this surprising claim by analyzing Nero, an aesthete who had an entire empire to fulfill his pursuit of enjoyment. Note that everything he says about Nero applies perfectly to Johannes the Seducer as well.
I picture, then, that imperial sensualist, not only when he ascends his throne or goes to the council meeting as he's surrounded by lictors, but also and mainly when he sets out to satisfy his appetites so that they can clear the way for his pirate expeditions. I imagine him as a somewhat older person. His youth, his past, his buoyant disposition has drained away, and he's already familiar with every imaginable pleasure, already sated with them. Then the spirit masses within him like a dark cloud. Its wrath broods over his soul, and it becomes an anxiety that does not cease even in the moment of enjoyment. This, you see, is why his eyes are so dark that no one can bear to look into them. His glance so flashing that it alarms. For behind the eyes, the soul lies like a gloomy darkness. Nero's nature was depression. What then is depression? It is hysteria of spirit.
Judge William says that aesthetic existence is not only immoral, it's self-defeating. The aesthete seeks enjoyment only to find melancholy, despair, and unhappiness. This opens the way for William to argue that the ethicist beats the aesthete at his own game by enjoying life more fully, By making enjoyment his ultimate goal, the aesthete not only becomes jaded in the end, but also puts an intolerable weight on every potentially enjoyable situation. But the ethicist, who's committed first and foremost to doing his duty, is free to let enjoyment happen unexpectedly. The judge is just one of many who's observed that happiness is one of those things we're much more likely to find if we're not looking for it. But Judge William has an even stronger claim that ethical existence is superior. He says a sense of duty both preserves and enriches life's aesthetic dimension. For example, marriage is the ethical expression of romantic love. Judge William uses this example to make his case. A and other aesthetes generally argue that marriage, with its vows and obligations, destroys romantic love. Judge William responds that the opposite's true. He says that erotic love in its spontaneous, immediate form always could die because infatuation is unreliable. But love that becomes duty is protected and preserved.
Love casts out fear. But if love nevertheless fears for a moment for its salvation, then duty is precisely the divine nourishment love needs. For duty says, "Fear not, you shall conquer." Says it not just in the future tense, for then it is only a hope, but in the imperative mood, and therein rests a conviction that nothing can shake.
According to Judge William, the historical character of married love, its essential persistence over time, makes it aesthetically superior to romantic love without marriage.
It is not true that marriage is an exceedingly respectable but tiresomely moral role, and that erotic love is poetry. No. Marriage is really the poetic. What first love lacks is the historical. Romantic love can be portrayed artistically in the moment. Marital love cannot. For an ideal husband is not one who is ideal once in his life, but one who is that every day. If one traces dialectically the development of the aesthetically beautiful, one will find that the direction of this movement is from spatial categories to temporal categories, and that the perfecting of art is contingent upon the possibility of gradually detaching itself more and more from space and aiming toward time. This constitutes the significance of the transition from sculpture to painting. Music has time as its element, but has no continuance in time. Its significance is the continual vanishing in time. It sounds in time, but it also fades. Ultimately, poetry is the highest of all the arts, and therefore also the art that best knows how to affirm the meaning of time. It does not need to limit itself to the moment, in the sense that painting does. Neither does it disappear without a trace, in the sense that music does. But despite all this, it, too, is compelled to concentrate in the moment. It has, therefore, its limitation, and yet this, that time is affirmed, is not a disparagement of the aesthetic. On the contrary, the more this occurs, the richer and fuller the aesthetic ideal becomes. How, then, can the aesthetic, which is incommensurable even for portrayal in poetry, be represented? Answer: by living it.
The ultimate artistic medium, the medium in which love, the ultimate aesthetic subject, can be most richly developed, is not painting or music or drama or poetry. It's life. More specifically, it's marriage. To hear the call of duty is not to surrender the aesthetic, but rather to experience it more richly. But how can A enjoy all the advantages and satisfactions of ethical existence? After all, he's an aesthete, a self who always acts experimentally, provisionally. He's not in a position to undertake lifelong commitments. Judge Williams, aware of this, he warns A not to undertake ethical projects. He warns him not to marry, to take a job, and so forth, until he becomes an ethical person. But how is A to do this? The judge's answer is simple. Choose yourself.
But I go back to my category. I am not a logician, and I have only one category, but I assure you that it is the choice of both my heart and my thought, my soul's delight and my salvation. I go back to the significance of choosing. But what is it then that I choose? Is it this or that? No, for I choose absolutely. And I choose absolutely precisely by having chosen not to choose this or that. I choose the absolute. And what is the absolute? It is myself in my eternal validity.
By choosing ourselves, Judge William means taking responsibility for ourselves as we find ourselves. This isn't a choice between good and evil. It's a choice to view our lives in terms of good and evil. It's the decision to live in a moral universe. If we choose the ethical existence, then we take all other choices seriously. This is why Judge William says that choosing oneself is also choosing to choose. He thinks this decision is such a serious matter that he adopts an almost religious attitude towards the words either or.
The words either or have always made a great impression on me, and still do. Especially when I say them this way, plainly and by themselves. They act upon me like an incantation formula, and my soul becomes exceedingly earnest. At times, is almost in a state of shock.
What a marked contrast this is to A's either-or. A tells us that if we do what we're thinking about doing, we'll regret it. Don't do it, we'll regret that too. Do it or don't do it, we'll regret it. Believing that nothing good is to be expected of any real choices, A avoids them. He experiments, he plays, he undertakes all these things tentatively. His decisions always stand open to recall and revision. So in either or, Kierkegaard presents, in the persons of A and Judge William, two very different ways of saying either or. He presses us to decide between them, and he scrupulously avoids telling us which to choose. Either or appeared in 1843, and those in Copenhagen who read it were perplexed by much of it. But they immediately recognized the two characters as typical of the day. A reflected the romanticism fashionable in the intellectual and artistic elites. The Seducer's Diary can be read as an expose of the sexual freedom championed in Friedrich Schlegel's book Lucinda, an important text of German romanticism. Judge William, in turn, represents bourgeois responsibility and decorum. So, to many readers, either or recreated the fundamental cultural conflict between traditionalists and the avant-garde. Circumstances have radically changed since Kierkegaard's day, but the same basic choices face us now. Mass communications and high culture both lure us with siren songs to the ideal of perfect enjoyment. But our day also has its Judge Williams. Wherever we're called to account for our actions, wherever duty's placed ahead of inclination, there the ethical lives.
This is the end of part 3. Please download part 4 to continue.